Hi, I'm Ken Bates. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hopefully, it tells a story like it is, from rags to riches, and then to multi-riches. And champions of Europe, twice, with Bates, post-Bates, to the Chelsea fans. Up the Blues.
Welcome back to The Blueprint, the narrative podcast that is taking listeners behind the scenes at Chelsea Football Club like never before. The full series will be dropping in May this year, telling the inside story of how the Blues went from Premier League also-rans to European champions. But right now, we're running a two-part special with former Chelsea owner Ken Bates. My name is Kerry Levy. I'm a documentary filmmaker and writer, and I'll be your guide throughout this journey. You'll also hear another voice at times, and that's Gary Hayes. Gary is an ex-football writer who has covered Chelsea for close to 20 years and has also worked for the club. We've spent 8 years piecing the Blueprint story together, and we're close to having it finished. If you're new to this feed, please follow us and also find The Blueprint on Twitter and Instagram at blueprint_pod for the latest updates. But now, it's time for part two of our Ken Bates special. In our first instalment, Ken spoke openly about how he saved Chelsea from financial ruin, right up to the club's role in the formation of the Premier League and the appointment of Glenn Hoddle as manager. As his story enters the mid-90s, Ken opens up like never before on his conflict with Matthew Harding, the reasons behind Ruud Gullit's surprise sacking as manager, before taking us inside the deal to sell Chelsea to Roman Abramovich.
So Ken, do you want to talk about Matthew Harding? Just maybe start from the very beginning to the end?
Yeah, I think it's important that he's placed on record, because so many things have been written about him. I told you previously about Chelsea pitch owners. And what I did was that because we wanted to make it independent, we got a site hut, which we set alongside the main old Chelsea offices. And I got Colin Hutchinson in to run it from Wimbledon, managing director of Wimbledon, but thought it wasn't going anywhere. So he wrote to Norwich and me, Chelsea, asking if there was a job. Norwich did reply. I invited him over and talked to him. He was a quiet, by and large, studious man, thoughtful questions, and I explained my vision of CPO and Chelsea. She took the job. I mean, we recruited a girl called Janet Rainbow, and I can't remember where she came from, but she had previous with Chelsea somewhere, I think. One of Janet's strong points was she made a note of everybody that came up on Baltershire. Anyway, she came to see me. I don't know whether it's worth anything, but you told me following everything up because you never know. I said, so. He told her I had a scruffy little buggering, dirty T-shirt, scruffy jeans, plimsolls, no socks, but he just paid £100 cash and bought a share. And as he was leaving, he said, tell him Ken Bates he wants any money. Call me, I'm a lot richer than he is. Well, you hear a lot of that in football. Made a note of his number, telephone number. So a few days later, I rang him up, invited him round, come and have lunch. Meanwhile, the Sunday Times do a rich list every year, 100 richest men in England. What was interesting, said Matthew Harding, 100. He is a director and shareholder of Benfields. Didn't mean anything to me. The people who really made the money were the brokers. Anyway, we had lunch at the Imperial Arms in the garden, which was my local. which subsequently became his, and we chatted away. What I was trying to do, since he had some money, allegedly, I was trying to raise £5 million in 500,000 to build the North Stand, which was the noisiest North Stand, crumbling terraces, no proper toilets, anything. And I thought, the way we're going to rebuild Stamford Bridge, do it in bits, because you never afford the lot. I outlined my ideas. He said, can I think about it? I said, yeah, sure. Well, he said, I'm not really into partnerships and that, and I'd like to think about it. He came to see me. He said, look, what I'd like to do, take up the whole 10, 500,000. And so then we negotiated. He said, well, I'll lend you as a loan because I need the interest on the loan. I want a return on my money and a seat on the board. And he explained that he was a Lloyd's underwriter. He was a Lloyd's broker. It was an abbreviated version. The full story came out later. He had 30% of Benfield's, which was privately owned, as the name would suggest, by Mr. Benfield. And they were quite successful. And when the Sunday Times did their rich list, to my surprise, 100 was Matthew Harding. And what they used to do is list the reasons why they come to the conclusion that they'd earned a place in that list. This was, Benfield is a Lloyd's insurance broker. They made £30 million last year, private company. So 10 times the profit is £300 million. And he has 30% of the company. So that makes him worth £90 million. Add on a few other bits and bats, puts up to £100 million. He's just in. Everybody believed it. Though I always thought a bit peculiar early on, he never seemed to have any ready money. And in fact, when he put his £5 million in, he made two funny payments, £2,500,000 and something. Another one was £2,400,000 and something. They added up to the £5 million. Turned out they have these dividends on his shares. And that gave him his £30 million. That made him the richest man, third richest, 100th richest man in England. And just the boy to back up Chelsea. So we got on all right at first. But when the chips were down and the stories came down, it turned out he's one of five children. His father was also a Lloyd's broker. And when he left school, said to Benfield, who was a friend of his, can you do me a favour and take Matthew? Because every job he's taken so far had been slung out. His shaggy hair looked more like a beetle than a... And went to work like it. Benfield told me later, first thing he did was march him down to barbers, take a short back and sides. And when Matthew objected, because Matthew was used to being a bit bombastic in every own way, he said, in that case, get out. So he had his short back and sides. And eventually, because this guy was such a good disciplinarian, Matthew became good at his job. I always say never allow prejudice to affect your judgment. And obviously I was prejudiced against Matthew, but he was obviously had some bright ideas and talent. And in one particular year, Benfield's had a bad year, and he went to Benfield and said, look, I made any money this year, but I've made a dollop. What about a bonus? And Benfield said, I'm going to give you some shares. So that's how Matthew got his 30% of Benfield. Didn't pay for them, other than my work. So this fictitious about he was a 100th million valuable person in England, I think there's a word for it, is it? But the trouble is, journalists read other people's. Take it for gospel. He always seemed to be short of money and drove an indistinct car. But he did buy a farm with some of his money that he got from Benfield's. And that's where they lived. Now, his clever idea, and I said earlier, never allow prejudice to affect your judgment. What you do, as you will know, you have an insurance policy. And every year, your broker writes to you and renews it. You say yes, and off it goes. Now, Matthew was a good talker, and he didn't bother with your car, that kind of stuff. He left that to the punters in the working in Benfield's. But he would go to a business, say, look, forget all this annual stuff. Let me do a three-year policy for you. I can get you a much better price, much better premium for 3 years because the underwriters. I've got this security of, now you've got 3 years business. And in return, he'll give you a lower premium. So you've got a guaranteed lower premium for 3 years, and on one condition, I will handle any of your claims. That'll be in the contract. I have to handle them. You can't have anybody else. But I'll guarantee you settlement in 60 days from me reporting the accident or claim or whatever it is to the underwriter. Because you may or may not know, half the problem in getting paid is getting bloody paid, which affects what you have to price to pay in the price to replace whatever you're claiming against. So you have a cash problem. So the idea of a three-year contract, lower premium, fixed premium, and a guaranteed payment in 60 days, win-win all round. He would then go to the right underwriters to get the best price, and it was the best price. He would squeeze a slightly bigger premium for himself, and he had a clause in the contract which I think he said they would pay him in 14 days of making the claim. This was the clever bit, because he guaranteed his client payment in 60 days after it being reported to the underwriter. And he was lucky at the timing, because it wouldn't work today. In those days, they paid 6, 7, 8, 9% in interest at the bank. So he would get the 3 years premium, pay the premium faithfully every year. So he had interest on 2/3 of the premium for 2 years, 1/3 of the premium for 1 year. And if there was a claim, he had the use of the money for 8 plus 10 weeks. So he's probably making more money on the interest. Very clever. Hats off to him. That was Matthew. But Matthew was a control freak. And he was never wrong. He just put himself about a bit. Became man of the people. He wanted to get control of Chelsea Football Club. He got the press on his side. Because don't forget, I'd been an enemy of the press for years. I challenged them. Corrected their many omissions. Usually in court. I picked up a lot of libel damages, tax-free. Who was the worst one? Because he was never wrong. But he gave a story to the Mail on Sunday about a meeting which alleged fraud and bribery on my part. And the meeting never took place. What was his name? You know, he said that Abramovich gave me the penthouse as a sop to go. So what happened was, when we negotiated, when Abramovich came to buy Chelsea, the price was agreed in the Dorchester Grill. Sorry, the Dorchester Italian Bar on the left-hand side as you go in, if it's still there. Price was 35p a share. The whole deal was done in 2 hours, 3 hours. And it was printed in the day in the Mail on Sunday, and Susanna picked it up because it was in the magazine. Because usually these things, these libels are difficult to prove. But there's only one problem. We'd bought the penthouse at Chelsea and one below in 1997-8 when we opened Chelsea Village. Now, the reason I sued him for libel is if I had refused the 35p, but this man said to Bonvich's right-hand man, give him the penthouse and that'll shut him up, do the deal. So I was offered the penthouse for free. And if I'd done that, I'd have been paid higher than the ordinary shareholder who got their 45p. I don't think it was nothing else. But I got 45p plus an £11 million penthouse. That's bribery. It's fraud. You name it. And how the sub-editor of the Mail on Sunday printed that, I can't believe it. And as usual, my bodyguard picked it up, sitting there, and all of a sudden the voice said, ha ha, got him. So what are you talking about? Come and read this, darling. I did. And I said, ha ha, yes, you have got him. But I'll make one little point. I think it's important. In all the years I was in football, from 19, when did I buy Oldham? 1963, till the day I left, I never took a penny out of football, not even in my expenses. Never took a salary, never took a fee, never took a bonus, never took anything. Because I did it because I just loved the game. That's one of the reasons why I wouldn't go back in it. Because it's not about football, it's about money.
So can you tell me a bit more about Harding's perceived obsession with Matt Letizia?
Harding had been carried on by Matthew Letizia. He carried his photograph and giving it a kiss, slept with it under his bed on it. So I'd had enough of this. So I called a board meeting and instructed Hoddle to be present, because normally you don't allow managers at board meetings. I said, OK, Matthew, we called him Matthew, let's take this bloody Matthew Letizia thing sorted out once and for all. I said, we can't afford it, because he'd been saying he'd fund it, right. Assuring Hoddle the money was there, Bates was the handicap. I said, so what are we going to pay him? Million a year? Yes. I said, plus National Health Insurance. So that makes it 1,150,000. Right. So that's so much a week. That's 21,500 or 22,000. Then what's his transfer fee going to be? I deliberately got him to make the numbers and agree them. I said, Hoddle, 10 million, 12 million? Yep. If you're going to sign a new contract, we'll probably have to move him to a new house or, you know. Then there's the interest on the transfer fee. Hoddle said, what interest? Dead silence. So I looked at Matthew, raised my eyebrows. Matthew looked down and said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. I've always remembered that phrase. I said, oh, so we will be paying you interest. I looked at Hoddle and laughed my belly balls off, because Hoddle had been told all the time, Hoddle, oh, I'll put the transfer fee out. Hoddle knew he couldn't afford 10, 12 million quid. So I think it wasn't too long after that that Dennis Roach negotiated his transfer down to a lower club, England. And that was typical Harding.
What are your memories of Matthew's fatal helicopter crash?
We were playing Bolton in League Cup away from home midweek, and we drove up because we lived near Amersham, so we were halfway up on the way to Bolton, M6, and you're there. Matthew, however, decided to charter a helicopter. And Matthew always looked for something on the cheap, despite his public reputation. He found a helicopter pilot who just started on his own, and he chartered this helicopter. So obviously the guy did it for cheap. We got home about 3 o'clock in the morning. Urgent message on the phone from the Sun. Would I please call? Chap told me there'd been a report of a helicopter crash in North Cheshire, in fog, allegedly. Didn't know anything about it, which I didn't. 9 o'clock that morning, the phone went with Alan Sugar on the phone, because we were mates. He said, Ken, I can tell you exactly what happened, because Alan is a qualified helicopter pilot and owned a helicopter. I was a qualified pilot and owned a plane. So he knew what he was talking about. He said, it hit fog. Nearly every pilot makes the same mistake. First of all, you don't fly if there's a warning of possible fog. And that warning had been put out. He said, but what everybody makes a mistake of, he goes down to try and see where he is. You know, usually try and find a motorway or something, and then you follow the motorway to get home or to wherever you, to your destination. He said, you don't do that. If you hit fog, you keep flying at the same height and in the same direction. He said, the chances of another helicopter pilot flying in the same direction at the same time as you is so unlikely, you can ignore it, but you don't. You go down and go down and go down. If you're unlucky, you hit the ground, which what Harding did. But this pilot, who was not licensed for hire or insured for public hire, hit the grounds at 140 miles an hour. And the trouble is that it was a field he hit, and at the end of the field was a wood. So he hit the wood at 140 miles an hour. Now, some says it went up in flames, but that had been an artistic license, but they were dead. And the tragedy about it is, a young girl from the Manchester Evening News, junior overnight reporter, was sent out to investigate the story, got killed in a head-on crash. I used to live in North Cheshire before I went to live in the Virgin Islands. And North Cheshire is an old salt plain Now, I don't know if you know much about it, but what they used to do is pump the seawater into North Cheshire, which is very near the sea. Then you'd leave it and it would evaporate. And there's your salt, which you'd dig off. I can't remember the chain of events, but it creates a lot of fog. But I had a full experience of fog. When I was older, we used to come down M56, A56, turn off, and I'd go along there, and there was my house on 90 acres of land. So, but the first time I'd never seen it, you were going along, all of a sudden, wham, we hit a fog. So I stopped the car and got out and stood up, the first thing you do. And it was the worst of all horrors. It was a local fog. When I say a local layered fog, when I stood up, looked over the Bentley, clear as anything. The fog ended here. And when I bent down, crouched down on the road, the fog ended here. It was just this band of, 3 feet or something like that. Impenetrable. But the worst part about it is, Matthew gave a lift up to one of the Bolton directors who didn't go back to London, obviously, so he wasn't in the aircraft. And he told me that Richard Branson was flying Branson's helicopter up, and they both landed in the same place to refuel. Branson's pilot said to Harding, "I wouldn't go any further." I said, "Why? What's wrong?" And he told him about the fog, threat of fog all the way up. And apparently Matthew said, no, it's all right, don't take nothing, go on, all right. Another grand waiting for us, get back on time, go on. But so, silly fella, took off, didn't land. That's how Matthew left Chelsea.
How would you describe your relationship with him, just as you saw it? It started off positively and then it sort of deteriorated and got worse, or, you know, because the fact that you named the stand after him, I think that shows your position in that you showed respect for him.
No,
still.
It was very emotional, you know. And Peter Lever, who was a big man in the city and specialised in becoming directors and chairman, and I had agreed that he would become the chairman in due course, was at the meeting. I said, we'll name the stand the Matthew Harding stand. I said, no. He said, don't be right. Oh, I said, go on. Won't do us any harm now. And he was right, I was wrong.
Because from you, that's an incredible gesture to do that.
We'll make mistakes.
So is that something you'd say you regret?
Yeah. Because it created an ongoing problem with the fans. I mean, this thing about he put £26 million in the club. Absolute rubbish. He built the ground. Absolute rubbish. He borrowed £5 million from the bank against his shares, but that was a lot. Never put anything else in.
His relationship with Glenn Hoddle?
Well, I don't know. But obviously he'd sucked up to him in some way or the other, because Hoddle was close to him. And Hoddle introduced his Lady Amour, soothsayers, faith healers and future forecasters, or whatever is the name for them, but I can't remember. And Matthew was completely under her spell. Oh, Matthew tried everything. He put private eyes on me.
What did that whole saga for 4 to 5 years do to you personally?
I've had a battle all my life in various, do whatever I've done, I finished up. So just sharpened the knife edge. He thought he was a street fighter, but I was a street fighter.
But does it suck the energy out of you, battles like that?
No, I knew he wasn't going to win. So maybe more irritated, more angry, because he was diverting Chelsea's growth. He put Chelsea back 5 years, at least.
Does it divert your energies, though?
When you're running a football club, there's always diversions and energies and people trying to have a poke at you. He thought he was the first. And he thought, some of the things you could do in the city, you could do in the strip back streets, and you can't.
Signing Ruud Gullit, to us as fans and to people, the wider picture of Chelsea, that was a game changer because of what it did in terms of the profile of the club, the type of player Chelsea were signing.
But the real trouble with Gullit, is that he believed his own publicity. Buchholz insisted on playing when he was past it because of the advertising, that's where the money was. And because he was a foreigner, lived abroad, I don't think he paid any tax on it, but that's another story. That's not my problem. But I finally said to him, "I'm sorry, Rude, but you're not playing anymore." I said, "Because you can't do it." And in fact, we were playing. Now, this is 1998. We won the FA Cup. And we were playing Arsenal in the two-legged semi-final.
Yeah, so this is the 97-98 season. Chelsea just won the FA Cup and then you played at Highbury.
And we lost 2-1. And we lost to Hullet was playing sweeper, which he wasn't. He thought we didn't have to do so much running about. So I sacked him after the game. And I sacked him the next day in the Chelsea Harbour Hotel. And then offered the job to Vialli. And he took it on the spot. He became player manager. And he got all the dressing room together on the night of the game and gave them an inspirational speech. He gave them all a glass of champagne. He said, "Gentlemen," this is almost word for word, but "gentlemen, we are one goal down at half time. We're going to win this game. This is a fresh start. And gentlemen, I toast you, my co-players, and my co-winners." Yeah! And that was it. And we never looked back. That's when we became champions of Europe.
Later on that year, when you beat Real Madrid.
1-0. And we got a letter from the president of UEFA congratulating us on winning the European Cup Winners' Cup and welcoming to the European elite. And another letter, similar letter, from the general secretary of UEFA. Not bad for a club that had never won anything. Long as came back to a champ.
Going back to Hullet, when you signed him, it was a free transfer with the Bosman ruling. Now, Chelsea, under your guidance, were really the first club to make
take
the most
advantage of it.
That was a deliberate strategy, though, right? That Chelsea would start looking to the Bosman ruling. I guess you must have loved that because you weren't spending money on transfer fees.
You're spending it on wages. As Alan Sugar said, money now is like prune juice. I said, "What do you mean, Alan?" He said, "Goes in the top, comes out the bottom." That was the premise, because he was trying to put a limit on transfer fees at the Premier League. And I asked him, and it's like prune juice, I asked him what he meant. So he told the startled 18-member chairman.
Did you notice a change around Chelsea when the likes of Ruud Gullit came? Because that same summer, you signed Mark Hughes, who was just as important for Manchester United.
Well, he was the bulldozer, wasn't he?
But did you feel that there was a shift in attitude towards Chelsea from the other chairmen, that they were like, "Hold up, we've got to sit up and
take..." No good asking me what I thought about 30, 40 bloody years ago. Otherwise, you'll think I'm a football reporter making that with you along. No, the thing about it was that players got more interested. There were people, only form I ever heard. And it was the age of the agents. And it was the age of football becoming of interest to the media. And I actually think the TV contributed to that, because now the press had a lot more to write about.
So how did it feel to get Chelsea to their second FA Cup final of the 90s in 97, but not only get there, but win the trophy?
What do you think? Hated every minute of it. I mean, ask a stupid bloody question.
I just want to get you in your words, though. I need Ken Bates to tell me how ecstatic and elated he was to win silverware as the owner of Chelsea Football Club.
I'd sat there, as I did the day we won the European Cup. We were champions of Europe. I sat there just looking around, enjoying it, watching all our fans doing things and seeing things they never ever dreamt they'd do in their wildest dreams. That was my greatest satisfaction. Always has been, because I've been one of them.
Should we just fast forward to when you sold Chelsea? Is that okay?
Let's put a few records right? And they said I had to sell because we were struggling with this, usual vague press crap. We owed 100 million quid. But to start with, 75 of that 100 million was a 10-year mortgage with an American bank. And we've always paid our interest on time. I mean, 8.75%, we always paid it on the 15th of December to the people who organised. That was the first thing. And then if you look at any business, even you, your little business, relatively speaking, you have debts, don't you?
Very minor, but yes.
Well, you have electricity bills, gas bills, telephone bills, rent rates, they're bills. Oh, shock horror. Chelsea owes £20 million. You have transfer fees, which you pay over a period of years. So it's 100 million, neither the mouse or the elbow. And with that late strike against Liverpool on the last day of that season, 2-1, we're in the Champions League. So we had over 20 million guaranteed, but Chelsea owed us over 100 million quid. First of all, reporters really correct their faults. And secondly, unless you take them to court, and then you get an apology, or the threat, and then you get an apology.
So the reports that prior to you selling the club to Mr. Abramovich that the club could have gone out of business, was that not the case?
Who said that?
It's what they write about now. That
who justified it?
I guess no one in your position has justified it.
I rang up a reporter on average about once a week and tried to correct his mistakes.
If we could, I guess, correct it now, really, just to...
No, it's very simple. These morons that write these gap fillers, let them rewrite them and justify their statement.
So had the club not been sold that summer, it would have been business as usual at Chelsea?
Hopefully, no. Hopefully, we'd be winning more games. Now, the real trouble is, the mistake I made, when Connie Hutchinson retired, I took on a chap called Trevor Birch. Now, Trevor Birch, business was one of insolvency. And what insolvency practitioners do, they tell the worst possible story to frighten all the creditors, to get them in the right mood to accept his proposal. Trevor Birch was not a constructive person. But I don't know who was chasing us for money. I mean, football clubs are always, not always, sometimes short, late in their transfer fees. But I don't know any outstanding writs we had. What I do know is the agent that handled, he was a merchant bank, because the money was in London, it was handled by an agent. We used to send the check to the agent in London on bank transfer, and they used to send it across to New York. But I do remember being told by him on one occasion that that was the third successive year he'd been rung up by a reporter saying that he'd heard a rumour that Chelsea couldn't find the interest, which is about £6.25 million. Just fishing.
When did you first meet Mr. Abramovich and how did that introduction happen?
Well, Trevor Birch was a very negative person. He said to me, I've got somebody who'll pay 140 million for the club. And I suggest you take it. I recommend you take it. And he got it from an agent who'd gone to see about something else. And somebody had just said, anything out of business? And we were trying to place some shares. He said, you know, anybody who'd like to buy a few shares in Chelsea? That was all he said, according to Trevor Birch. So we arranged to meet on the Thursday night at the Dorchester. It was only then that, oh, there's a Russian that's interested. Anyway, I sat there with Trevor Birch. Two guys walked in from the front door, from the left, and Trevor said, oh, it's a fairly well-known agent. I can't remember his name now. And as we did so, we noticed a movement across there. And two guys got up and walked across. It was a famous Abramovich. Well, he wasn't famous in those days. I'm the man who made him famous, as a newspaper reporter would write. And it was him. And of course, it was security. They were there all the time, but they waited till the other two came through. And I stood up with Birch. Then they came down. And I went through the corner table I'd reserved. And Abramovich just sat there nodding his head, listening. And they said, we don't want to I can't remember word for word now, but basically it's, we don't want a big signing, we want a quick deal. Can you try to buy Manchester United? We won for sale. And so then someone said, Bates, Chelsea. But it only came up in a casual conversation about something else.
So the deal to sell Chelsea was done that night in the Dorchester?
Yep. We arranged to meet at the office at 8:30 in the morning, and I rang two people to tell them to be there without fail. I said, what for? I said, I'll tell you when you get there. So there was no possible leak. And we did the deal and agreed it. And at 4 o'clock that afternoon, I rang our, because we were ARM, so we were NOVAD, nominated advisors. If we went on the main stock exchange, AIM, alternative investment market, you had to have somebody to be responsible for you. I forget who we had now. Robert Ellis, Ellis and Partners. And they came in at 4 o'clock. I waited till the stock exchange had closed. I can't even tell the stockbrokers. They came in. I said, I've just done a deal, accept a bid for Chelsea. So and so. Please notify the stock exchange, as is your obligation. The senior partner of the stock exchange, stroke merchant banker, who hadn't been involved, because I'd fallen out with him for some time, jumped on the bandwagon and then tried to say, well, our normal commission is 6 weeks. What for? What for? Making a phone call? I don't know. And he said, threaten this. I said, threaten what you like? I said, well, I tell you one thing. Won't do your reputation among your clients any good, will it? I think they gave him a few bob to shut him up, but I never had him.
When you first met Mr. Abramovich that Thursday night, what was your initial impression of him?
He's very quiet, a little bit surprised because he was dressed in his usual billionaire's uniform, though I didn't know he was a billionaire at the time. Can I answer the question?
Yeah, just interesting.
He's very taciturn. He had two good guys with him. I'm not saying about the others because I didn't know who they were. But the guy that spoke for him, well, the two of them spoke for him, were very cultured, very cultured, very knowledgeable, very quiet, very modest, not bombastic. The complete opposite of Harding, with a few more noughts.
And in that moment, did you ever expect that he would spend the level that he did?
Well, of course I didn't. I didn't know how much he was worth.
The story we're telling is that we think it's been forgotten that what happened in the 90s at Chelsea especially, that Chelsea wouldn't exist in the way that we know it now without that period.
In my days, you won things. Today, you buy things. Although I say myself, what I did at Chelsea, I did on the smell of an oily rag. So you can't compare that with this. Let me tell you one thing which really sums it up. That is, I thought that Chelsea would continue as it was with an injection of money and a gradual changeover. You know?
Do you feel your place in Chelsea history, you feel proud of everything you achieved because you set it up so that the club could become what it's become? Because
we're called speak for itself. I rest my case. Me lad.
In this episode, Ken Bates discussed some of the circumstances surrounding Matthew Harding's tragic death in a helicopter crash on 22nd of October 1996. We've spoken to many people for this series about the tragedy, including Harding's friend and solicitor for the family estate, David Cooper. You'll be hearing more from David when the full series is released, but for now, we need to clarify some points raised in this episode. David oversaw the inquest into Harding's death and has explained to us that there is no record of Harding or his pilot meeting Richard Branson or his pilot en route to Bolton or London. Also, there were no earlier warnings of fog or hazardous conditions on the evening in question. Harding's pilot, Tony Goss, was not qualified for night flights as his licence had lapsed, which meant he had to land when visibility was poor. Goss was disorientated on the evening of the crash and had flown more than the legal hours. Goss was also the pilot for Tony Blair, the former leader of the Labour Party and a future UK Prime Minister. It is understood that Harding used Goss's services on the recommendation of Blair, who had flown in the helicopter just weeks earlier without issue. The Blueprint will return in May this year with an array of voices to tell the story of how Chelsea Football Club changed the modern game.
There was obviously a lot of controversy around the game, and that, I think that fired us both up for the second leg. We flew out and played some of the, probably the best 20 or so minutes of football that Stamford Bridge has ever seen, I would say.
That was the night where UEFA would have to sit up and take notice and say, oh, wait a minute, there's another superpower here.
He kept talking to me, Luca, about Guardiola, and he was like, listen, he said, everything goes through him. He's unbelievable.
You know, Mata was struggling a little bit in extra time. He was struggling, so I was, if you look at the game, you know, I was getting Paulo Ferreira warmed up so many times, poor boy. You know, because every time something happened, he was a player that was going to, had to come on, because if somebody was dropping down, he was going to be replacing anybody, and we had to shuffle around a little bit.
If you've liked what you've heard already, please give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends about The Blueprint. We'll see you all in May. The Blueprint has been written and produced by Gary Hayes and me, Kerry Levy. Our theme music, Blue Day 23, was composed by Mike Canaris, with bed arrangements by Jake Bradford Sharp, and is used under license from Macasso Music. Vocals are by the Blueprinters, Alison Bender, Chiara Cervazio, Karen Edith Miller, Louis Beneventi, Daniel Childs, and Gary and myself. Leon Radchinsky-Gorman has mixed the series, and Mark Jardine is our designer. Consultant producers for the series are Nick Lapworth, Neil Pacchietto, and Jackie Anklin. We would also like to thank Gary Link from The Missing Link, Taylor Hayes, and everyone who has spoken to us for this series, on and off the record. If you like this series, please share it with your friends and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to another Highway 61 production. For more podcasts like this one, visit www.highway61.media. That's HWY61.media.